Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Today's guest is Dr. Anne Rathbone Bradley, the Vice President of Economic Initiatives at the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics, where she develops and commissions research towards a systematic biblical theology of economic freedom. She is a visiting professor at Georgetown University and also teaches at the Institute for World Politics and at George Mason University. Additionally, Professor Bradley is a visiting scholar at the Bernard Center for Women, Politics, and Public Policy. Previously, Anne taught at Charles University in Prague and served as the Associate Director for the Program in Economics, Politics, and the Law at the James M. Buchanan Center at George Mason University. And is co-editor of and contributing author to the recent book, Counting the Cost, Christian Perspectives on Capitalism, and also edited For the Least of These, A Biblical Answer to Poverty. In both these works, Dr. Bradley examines income inequality from both an economic and biblical perspective and provides guidance to Christians on how to respond, particularly through their vocations. Anne's other academic work has focused on the political economy of terrorism, with specific emphasis on the industrial organization of Al-Qaeda. And she is currently working on a book that analyzes the political economy of Al-Qaeda in the post-9/11 period. Links to Anne's biography, her books, and other cool stuff can be found over at our website, so please visit us. Anne, welcome to Research on Religion.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for having me.
That is a really unique and nifty sounding entity that you work for there, the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics. And the acronym would be IFWE. So yes. If we could you tell me a little bit about this place?
See, that's exactly why we did that. We wanted to be that to be a turn of phrase. I wish I could say that I had the genius idea, but I think it actually happened on a golf course where I'm convinced all good ideas emerge. And our executive director, Hugh Walshall, and a theologian friend, Art Lindsley, who I wrote this book with, had this idea that over the last 150 years or so, evangelical Christians in particular, and that's who our audience is primarily, have really siloed their faith and their work. And they thought that this was a bad thing, and that if you look at the work of the Reformers in particular, who we're very influenced by in our thinking at the Institute, they did not advocate this or think that this was biblical, that we were created to work, and that that has really big social, legal, political, and economic implications. And so that was the start of the organization. So I came on at the beginning. We're about 6 years old, so we're a baby organization, but we really try to provide a comprehensive framework for Christians to think about what it means to be a Christian in 2017, that the Bible actually has important prescriptions for how we're to live our lives. And then if we take those things seriously, we actually need a free society. We need lots of economic freedom. We need markets so that we can engage and exchange, and that this is the way to flourishing. So flourishing is the goal. And what we talk about a lot at the Institute is how to carve that path to flourishing and how to think about our unique role that we each have in that process.
And what kind of outreach do you have? You mentioned you work toward connecting with evangelical Christians, but do you do this through radio, television? Do you have seminars? What kind of things do you do in order to connect with people?
That is an evolving process, I would say. We have a blog, so we publish that blog 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, but we do a lot of the things you mentioned. Art and I and Hugh, our executive director, we do a lot of public speaking events, and we attend academic conferences, so we do a lot of production of content, and that can be from a blog to a journal article to books. We've kind of dabbled in curriculum, so we've developed in last summer two different homeschool curriculum that can be used with the family to talk about vocation. That's one. And the other is kind of an introduction to the economic way of thinking. So we're trying to grow our reach. We work a lot with university professors, but we also want to be in the church and talk to pastors and help them have a way to talk about this with their congregations.
A very cool mission, and one of the ways you do that is by talking to people on podcasts, and that's what we're doing now.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So let's dig into your most recent book. You co-edited this with your colleague, Art Lindsley, who you just mentioned there. This is entitled Counting the Cost, Christian Perspectives on Capitalism. What motivated the writing of that volume?
Well, we started just by looking around us, really, and kind of looking at the dialogue and the rhetoric that was as it was unfolding, particularly leading up to the most recent presidential election, but really kind of even before that, and trying to understand the conversations that Christians were having about how they should feel about their economic and political systems. There's a lot of a diversity of opinion, I'll say, on that. You know, some Christians are very right-wing in their politics, some are left-wing in their politics. There's a lot of disagreement over, does the Bible advocate whether you know what position you should take? And particularly with capitalism, this word has so much baggage that I think Christians don't know how to feel about it, or maybe even don't know what it is. And so what we wanted to do is bring together the best and the brightest. It's an edited volume. There's a lot of different authors that are weighing in here who've thought about this for a long time. And we try to make each chapter a response to a unique critique that Christians bring to the idea of capitalism. So does it motivate, you know, materialism? Does it exploit the environment? Does it exploit the poor? So these are real critiques that we want to take seriously. And each chapter is an attempt to wrestle with that critique. And at the end of the book, you know, hopefully readers have a way to or a framework to think about what capitalism means and, you know, how do they participate in it? How should they feel about it?
Yeah, you covered a lot of the topics that are in there, from environmentalism to income inequality. We'll talk about a number of these things today, maybe not all of them, so people will have to go out and take a look at the book. It's written very nicely, very accessible, not a whole lot of graphs or charts or tables. So for those worried about economic jargon and all that kind of stuff, this is a very jargon-free discussion, very, very accessible. The book is on capitalism, though, and you mentioned that that's a big word when it comes up in discussions in evangelical circles or in the media that can be packed with a lot of different things. And I've always warned my students that the word, any word that ends in either an ism or an ization, like globalization, usually is a pretty big concept that people can pour whatever they want into defining it. So let's step back a moment and start with how you and your fellow authors define capitalism.
Yeah, that's the place we wanted to start. And we wrestled with whether we should use the word capitalism in the title. And then we thought, well, you know, it begs so many questions, we have to. This is, you know, the fundamental question that we try to address. So what is it? What is capitalism? And the way that each author tries to wrestle with this and provide some illumination to what this is, but what we really say, kind of, if I had to put it on a postcard, I would say that capitalism is a question over who owns the decisions about how to use resources. So the means of production, you know, what businesses are started by whom, how are they going to manipulate raw materials into final products? These types of questions are about taking an existing set of resources and producing them into something else. And the question is, who makes those decisions? And how are those decisions, how do they evolve through the economy? And another way, I mean, I'm an economist, so the way that I would kind of add to that is that it's about exchange through profit and loss. So the market process of prices and profits and losses is really the mechanism by which resources continue to be used in new and different ways. So you're not relying on a commissar, you're not relying on the president, you're not relying on an economic czar to say, you know, we're going to decide how many houses are going to be built this year in the United States, and this person's going to decide how many, you know, books we're going to have or how many pencils we're going to have, but that the market does that in a decentralized way.
So that's a good definition of what capitalism is, but there are some ways to define that on what it is not, because there's a lot of popular conceptions what capitalism is. We get them from literature, places like Charles Dickens, from movies, places like Wall Street and things like that. You have a couple authors in your book who actually deal with this. David Kotter writes a chapter on, is capitalism based on greed? And then you also have another one by, I think it's Connor, who's Joseph Connor, examining whether capitalism is exploitative. Could you kind of address those issues?
Sure. I agree with that. I liked the way you presented this, which is that when we have isms, we have everything. And that's not helpful. And so we kind of say, what is it not? And how do we think through that? And I think if the way to start with this is a little thought experiment. If we were to survey 100 people on the street, just randomly any street corner, and ask them what capitalism was, I think we would get 100 different answers. And most of them would include a lot of what it's not. So you'd hear something about, well, the rich taking, you know, more for themselves and exploiting the poor. It's about people being greedy. It rewards those only at the top. And really, what we offer in this book is that that is not what capitalism is about. Capitalism is actually the antithesis of just rewarding those at the top. In fact, to get to the top, you have to not exploit people in a capitalist system. Now, you know, there are bigger questions about how do we preserve a capitalist system so that it doesn't get perverted into other things, and those are real questions we want to address. But the authors, you know, examine how the mechanisms of capitalism work through the market, again, of exchange, commercial exchange through prices, which are driven by profits and losses, and what does that result in? And what we see is that it results in less exploitation. It results in a world where you can start out as poor and end up having a lot. You know, you could be Bill Gates, but you might be upper middle class. And that's what we want to think about is, how do we transition out of societies that are destined to be poor? Because that's really the story of human history for most of it. And so the authors are really trying to address that capitalism is not about a rigged corporatist system where the people at the top get to exploit those at the bottom. In fact, capitalism is the best pathway out of those types of systems.
One of the other chapters you have in the book is written by Joy Buchanan and Vernon Smith. And Vernon Smith is a Nobel laureate, by the way. So congratulations on getting some heavy hitters into this volume.
Thank you.
He's a really neat guy. He's down at Chapman University now. He was at George Mason for a bit, probably when you were there, if I'm correct, right?
That's correct. Yeah, that's correct.
And Vernon's a neat guy. They wrote a chapter called Who Benefits from Capitalism? And you mentioned just a few minutes ago that if we ask people on the street, what is capitalism? They'll say, well, it benefits this 1% that take away from everybody. What are they saying about who benefits from capitalism and who doesn't?
This is a great chapter for all the reasons that you mentioned. There's two very bright people that we were lucky enough to have as part of this volume. And really kind of providing a lot of clarity and starting with the biblical perspective of what is it that we're to do and does capitalism help us do that? In other words, is capitalism a system that allows us to live into our human creativity, to work, to help our neighbor, if you will, or is it one that kind of just fosters cronyism and, you know, the rich benefit? And their story is one that really presents a great picture of the last 2,000 years of human history. And, you know, they make some really important claims that are empirically verified. So they're telling the truth here. They're observing the world. And they say, you know, really since the birth of Jesus, all increases in economic growth and output have occurred in the last 200 years. So we're living in an amazing time. And who benefits from this amazing time? Ordinary people benefit. I don't have to be a king or a queen or born into a certain caste or born into a certain family to have electricity in my house, to have access to a laptop, to walk around with a cell phone in my pocket. In fact, I'm an ordinary person and I get to take these things for granted, and that's a real luxury. And these luxuries are being extended to the masses. And again, they ask the question, well, why is that? And it's because capitalism provides the incentive for the very rich, like the Bill Gateses of today, to have to think about the ordinary people, about what they want, about what they need, and to fight to get it to them. And how does that happen? It happens through better products that are more affordable, higher quality, and in greater quantity. So this is the story that they're telling, and that benefits everyone. Again, we don't want to just benefit the rich. They're already doing okay. And most of history has been the rich kind of exploiting the poor. So capitalism gets us out of that. Again, it's the pathway out of persistent poverty.
And you just mentioned that both Buchanan and Smith take this all the way back 2,000 years to the birth of Christ, the beginnings of Christianity. And you know, the even before then, the history of humanity has been dire poverty. And in the last 200 years, we see that change. But over the last 2,000 years, we get this thing called Christianity. So you and your fellow authors bring a biblical perspective to the examination of capitalism and all the changes that it has wrought in human society. And you ask if this economic system falls within the boundaries of a Christian theological perspective of society and for godly living. A question that many people have wrestled with, from Augustine, Aquinas, to folks like C.S. Lewis and others. So one of the first chapters, actually it's the second chapter in the book after the introduction, is written by Jonathan Pennington, and that tackles the topic of what the Bible teaches us about human flourishing. So even before we get to capitalism, that you guys are starting to think about what is this thing that we want that to humans have human flourishing. So go over Pennington's arguments for us and what this whole flourishing thing means.
Absolutely. And you know, this is the what. This is what are we after as Christians who believe that the scripture provides insights into not only how we're to live, but why we're here. I mean, why are we here? And the reason we're here, as Pennington details very thoroughly, is we're here to promote and experience human flourishing. So that's kind of too double-sided there. We're to promote it, but we're to experience it. We're to live in it. And so this idea of human flourishing is a very big idea. You know, and he talks about this, that we tend to, when we read the scriptures, we see the word shalom, both in the Old Testament and translations on that in the New Testament. And we tend to just kind of shortcut that in a definitional way to peace. And he talks about how that's a very narrow and not sufficient definition. And peace just means the absence of conflict. I always like to say it this way. We want peace and harmony, but they don't always go together. You can have peace without having harmony. And flourishing is much bigger than just peace. I'm not beating up my neighbor and stealing their stuff in the middle of the night. I'm actually enjoying living in my neighborhood, and there's kind of a richness to human interaction. And so he talks about that, and he starts right with, you know, Genesis, the first chapter of the Bible, and says, you know, this is why we're here. We're here to extend God's creation. We're each made in his image. Being made in his image means we have dignity, we have purpose, and we have a job to do. We have responsibilities. And so when we can live into our human creativity, when we can elevate our own dignity and the dignity of others, then we have the best chance of really experiencing human flourishing. And I think the way he would summarize it is to say human flourishing is the working of society the way it's supposed to be. And this is not just about commercial exchange, but what he says in there, which I think is quite provocative for Christians, is that material well-being is part of biblical flourishing. Again, I think if you surveyed Christians, would they say, is it okay to be rich? You'd get a lot of different answers. And I think the answer, of course, is it depends. You know, did you steal the money or did you earn it? There's lots of those types of questions that this book addresses. But in particular, Pennington is saying longevity, fertility, well-being, which requires material well-being, is good. And so that brings us right to the bigger question of the book, which is, does capitalism get us there? Does it get us more human flourishing?
Now, you mentioned Genesis and the concept of shalom. Those are all Old Testament types of concepts. He also brings this up to the New Testament, and I think most people would when asked, would say, well, Jesus was really wasn't into the whole materialism thing. You know, think about the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount that usually comes up right away. So how is the New Testament dealing with this question of human flourishing?
And he does this very well. And he kind of takes these ideas of shalom and blessing and wholeness. And he says, if we look at the language of the Greek in the New Testament, we see that these ideas, we don't abandon them. They're deepened and they're extended. And so what's the difference for Christians is that in the New Testament, we have a new covenant and we have reconciliation through the birth and ultimately the death of Jesus Christ, which is an atonement. And again, it allows us to live into God's redemptive work. And so, you know, the Sermon on the Mount, you mentioned, which is an example of Jesus giving us a view of what shalom looks like. We have a better understanding of well-being. We have a better understanding of the fullness and richness of God's kingdom. And so the New Testament takes those ideas and extends them, and now we have a means that we didn't have before. We have Christ who's providing reconciliation, and we have the grace of the new covenant. And so human flourishing is materialized or realized in a different way than perhaps in the Old Testament. But the concepts don't go away. They're enriched.
Now, one of the interesting lines in that chapter that caught my attention, and I'm not a philosophy major. I've read philosophy, but it sometimes confuses me. Pennington says that the Christian concept of human flourishing is not the, quote, tyrannical concept of Kantian altruism, unquote. And that's interesting, because normally we think of the way to get to a better society is through altruism. Now, what is he talking about here? First of all, what's Kantian altruism? And then why is it a tyrannical concept? And how do you folks address that?
Yeah, this is, and, you know, Pennington was, he's a theologian with deep philosophy roots, and I'm like you, I am not a philosophy professor nor major, I am not an expert here, but I think he does a really good job of helping us kind of understand some of the historical perspectives around flourishing. And, you know, this line about the unbiblical specter, as you mentioned, of Kantian altruism is right from C.S. Lewis in his essay, The Weight of Glory. And so he's leaning on that, and he's saying, you know, the idea that it's bad to desire what's good for us and hope for it, and to enjoy life, to enjoy what's good for us, is, you know, the idea that that's a bad thing comes from this kind of rigid Kantian altruism, which is all about duty. It's all about living a life of adherence, strict adherence to the duties that you have, not so much about individual flourishing and not about human happiness. And so, you know, he's saying here, this is unbiblical, because he spends the whole chapter saying, look, human flourishing includes happiness. It's not just suffering. It's not, you know, kind of a life of being quiet and never enjoying anything. But this is unbiblical. God created us. And, you know, Pennington, I think, would want us to go back to Genesis. Look at the world we were created in. It is a world of abundance. It is a world of lots of potential. If you read those first two chapters of Genesis, this is language of abundance. It's not language of poverty and destitution and, you know, not enjoying anything. So I think he's very worried about this idea of Kantian altruism, because it's strict adherence to duty at all times. No insight about happiness. In fact, maybe happiness we should avoid at all costs, because somehow that means we're enjoying life too much. And I think it's right to point out that that's not the biblical narrative of what flourishing is and how we accomplish it. We, you know, God wants us to enjoy the things he's given us and the fruits of our labor.
That's a really good point, because I see this throughout history and in contemporary times here, the idea of duty, that there's misery in the world and I have to be miserable as I go into the world to deal with this, and I can't be happy until all poverty is eradicated. And for me personally, when I run across some of these folks, and they're always kind of angry and upset about the conditions of the world and say, why aren't you, you know, more concerned about this? I said, well, if you're going to go out and help people, wouldn't you want to be helped by a happy warrior rather than a miserable warrior? you know, these conscience duty people who, you know, says, I have to do this and I'm going to make it better for you. Instead of like, hey, how you doing? Let's build things together. Let's be cool. I don't know. My reflections on that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, it's just not. And if you look at the life of Jesus, he's a really good example for Christians of how we should live. He was a happy guy. He enjoyed friendships and relationships. I mean, that I think is part of the foundation of Christianity that we don't always talk about. And I don't know how that fits into kind of a narrative of Kantian altruism, that there's enjoyment, that long lingering conversations over dinner are good for their own sake, because in that we are building community and trust and compassion. And we're gathering information about the world we live in, and those things are so important. Particularly in a market society, become more important because we're dealing more and more with strangers as we get richer. And so this idea of enjoyment and fulfillment should not be lost.
Let me ask you what that meant. As we get richer, we deal more with strangers, because that's a very important concept that comes up very early in another profound author, Adam Smith. So explain this whole strangers thing.
Absolutely. This is what one of my favorite things to talk about in my own classroom is this idea of trust and strangers, because those things don't seem to go together. We don't trust strangers. I mean, I have very small children, and, you know, the kind of messages are everywhere, don't talk to strangers. And my thought is, well, if my four-year-old runs away from me, I really want her to talk to a stranger to get help if I'm not there. And so this idea that strangers are bad, it kind of pervades our culture, I think. But what Adam Smith was really focused on there is that, you know, markets allow us to exchange with people that we don't know. So, you know, to go back to Vernon Smith and Buchanan's chapter, what they're detailing there empirically is that most humans over most of human history have not been able to deal extensively with strangers. They've only been able to deal with the people that live near them, which is kind of just an accident, right? I mean, I don't know who my neighbor is. They have a farm down the road. If I want to trade something with them, I have to kind of develop a relationship. And there's just a lot of costs associated with that. And I'm very limited. If I'm in the middle of Kansas, you know, 200 years ago, it's not easy for me to trade with my fellow human being in China. But what Adam Smith noted is that as we broaden these circles of exchange, there's more strangers with whom we are dealing, and that in that process, if the institutions are right, we actually get more trust, not less. It's a counterintuitive notion, but really an important one, I think. You know, we need to understand that the capitalism actually provides the mechanisms for us to trust people we will never know and never meet.
That's a good segue into the next thing that we want to talk about here. We just talked about human flourishing and how that manifests itself in the Old and New Testaments. And now we want to talk about how we get there. And the typical way most folks think about this, at least at a superficial level, is that in order for society as a whole to flourish, individuals have to squash their self-interest and act altruistically. And this seems counter to the typical notion of capitalism that we mentioned a few minutes ago, because capitalism is seen as the pursuit of self-interest and profit, exchange and profit, as you said earlier. Now, you have two chapters in this volume that deal with that question writ large, one of them by the late Michael Novak, who passed away earlier this year, I think back in February, and then the other one by Art Lindsley, your co-editor. What is their general defense of capitalism in being congruent with Christianity?
Yeah, so we are so blessed to have Michael Novak as part of this volume, and he is really a groundbreaker, probably one of the most important contemporary thinkers on these ideas. And so for Novak, I think what he has to offer here is that we want to live in a society that elevates the inherent dignity of each person. And we need a free society to do that. But for Novak, it wasn't just all economics. So he wasn't an economist. But even then, I think what he brings to this is that it's much more nuanced and complex than that. We need political systems that do that and political institutions that support human dignity. We need economic institutions, which was a market-based system for him in a free society. And then we need a culture that supports these ideas. We need a pluralistic culture where people can come and question and seek truth, and that the combination of those things, he called it the three-legged stool, that the combination of those things provides a very robust platform for a flourishing society, and that that's very much in accordance with what the Bible desires for us and how we live, that we need to be free so that we can pursue what God wants each of us individually to pursue, and that a tyrannical state, a socialist state, can never do that because you don't have any of the elements of the organic exchange of ideas, commercial exchange, and sound political institutions. You're just putting all the hands in the power of one person, and so I think that is generally what Novak would say here. And what's so powerful about Novak in particular is he's a convert to this way of thinking. A former kind of advocate of socialism comes around to these ideas, and I think there's a lot of power in that because he had these insights about how the world was changing, and he was very thoughtful about how should he change his ideas, or should he, given that he believed the Bible to be true. So I think it's a very powerful essay. His thinking in general is very important. What Art Lindsley does is, really kind of addresses some of the common concerns that Christians have over this kind of capitalism versus socialism debate. So you'll get Christians who will say, capitalism is good, let's do that. And there are some who will say, socialism is the way to go, and Jesus was a socialist. And he actually tries to look at those claims and evaluate them. One in particular, he would take us to Acts 2 through 5, which he does in this chapter. And, this is commonly cited amongst thought leaders and Christians who would say that Jesus is a socialist or was a socialist. And the argument is as follows. In the early church, and this is detailed in Acts 2 to 5, there was a lot of sharing that went on in the church. So people kind of came into this community and shared with each other, and their resources were held in common. And so that's the kind of the scriptural reference, and some hang their hat on it and say, okay, well, that means Jesus wants socialism, and it's a prescriptive text. And what Art is very thoughtful about is he goes through the original Greek, and he looks even at the kind of the tenses of the words used, because he wants to try to understand, is this a prescription for how all economies should be run? Or is this a narrative text that's explaining something specific that happened in a specific time among a specific people? And if so, what principles can we learn from it? And there's a really important distinction here. And where he lands, and you see when you read the chapter, is that you can't get, basically what he says is you can't get, is out of ought. So because this behavior was engaged in this particular, in the early church, it's not a prescription for how all society should be run, that we should commonly hold all of our resources, and that we should share everything. And I think that's really important. He also would say the Bible isn't just kind of a rubber stamp for capitalism either. He says we need to be thoughtful about the principles that Scripture gives us about how to live and what we're supposed to do. And then in an imperfect world, we're not going to have a perfect system, because all systems, political and economic and otherwise, are made up of human beings. So we have to find the one that best fits. And I think that's, again, where Novak and Lindsley are very similar. Not, necessarily cheerleaders for capitalism in the sense that it does no wrong, but that it's really the best way to live into what Scripture commands us to do, which is to work hard, to use our creativity to extend God's creation and to contribute to flourishing.
Yeah, I really liked Art's chapter a lot, because he starts out by saying, listen, this is not a primer for capitalism here. So if you're out there picking up the New Testament looking for that, you're not going to find that. But you're also not going to find the socialist aspect of this as well. And his focus on Acts, I think, is very interesting. And as you were talking about this, I was just thinking about wedding this to a lot of work by economic historians. We've had a few on our show, Jared Rubin and Gary Richardson and folks like that. And they note that at different points in time, different societies, different levels of technology, different sizes of societies, you we have different types of organizations. So in a smaller community 2,000 years ago, you know, sharing of communal resources was probably the best thing to do. And it was easy to do because of the relatively small size. But as you note, as we get into more anonymous trade or trade with strangers, that's got to change a little bit. One of the things that Art also talks about is private property and the role of government, and that's a big issue. We kind of touched upon it a little bit by saying, well, it's not all just sharing is caring kind of stuff, but what does Art bring out about the role of private property in his chapter?
Sure. He's very careful here as well, and he would say, let's look at the Ten Commandments. If we're Christians, that's kind of a good starting point to understand how we're to live and what rules that we're to follow. And, you know, they deal with private property rights. Thou shalt not steal. To steal means I take something that's not mine. And if there's no sense of property rights, then I can never call anything mine. And so he sees that property rights are an important, again, mechanism that God details in the scriptures that provide a way for us to kind of live amongst each other. As you mentioned, this is a really important idea of property rights as we deal with more strangers. I have to have a boundary line. I have to know what's mine and what's yours, but it's more than that. I have a way to arbitrate disputes. I have to have a way to transfer some or all of my property to you. This gets more sophisticated in modern, globalized cultures with sophisticated technology. But it's something that we have to figure out. The scriptural importance of private property, he would say, we need to pay attention to that. And that has to factor in to the economic system for which we advocate. So he would say, you're not also going to get a prescriptive for communism here either, because if you eliminate property rights, you're violating one of these principles of scripture, which is that property rights are good, they're important, they allow us to be good stewards. And this also factors very clearly into the role of government. If I can own something, and that even just the ownership of myself, I come to the government with that right. I come to the government with that inalienable property right in myself. The government doesn't give me rights. It's supposed to protect them. Now, that's a very specific way of thinking about the role of government. Again, communism is incompatible with this because, you know, the government assigns me some rights, but I exist to serve the state, and the state is in charge. I don't necessarily, and I'm not sure how you have human dignity in that context. It's a very hard thing to think about, again, unless you have some sort of benevolent dictator in charge, but history shows us that doesn't happen. And so these ideas of private property and the role of government are very much connected, and again, they have big implications for what type of economic system. Capitalism is an economic system by which the private property rights of individuals must be protected. Otherwise, it doesn't work.
Let's take up your chapter on wealth inequality specifically now, which is titled, The 1% is Income Inequality Evidence of Exploitation. So we talked about property rights. We talked about generating wealth and why capitalism can do that. We talked about human dignity. But many people would argue that capitalism sometimes generates a lot of inequality. And there's a lot of talk nowadays about income and wealth inequality with the popularity of Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century book. So what are the dimensions of this problem, and how much of a problem is it?
This is such a good question. I think I could spend the rest of my life thinking about and writing on income inequality. I don't know if that will make me a happier person in terms of flourishing. I'm not sure. But it's such a nuanced problem, and you're right. Piketty's book has had a profound influence on this argument and debate, but I think this debate is as old as time. You know, the kind of idea of there's the rich and there's the poor, and the poor will never be rich, and the rich get to stay rich because they exploit the poor. I mean, these are real problems, and historically we can point to much evidence that this has happened over history. And so again, the question is, how do we remedy this? And is it, we can't know the answer to that question without understanding how we measure income inequality, how do we wrestle with it, but really, how does the inequality emerge? So I can talk about a little bit of each of those things, if that's appropriate here. One, I think, is just, how do we measure it as economists? Without getting super technical, we use something called the Gini coefficient, and it's really just a statistical measure to understand in a given area that we're measuring. I mean, we can measure this in our classrooms. We could measure it in our town. We could measure it in a village. We measure it country to country. And what we're doing there is kind of at a point in time, we're trying to understand how income is held across different households. And we usually do this by looking at tax returns. Just very briefly, Gini coefficient ranges from 0 to 1. If the Gini coefficient is 0, it means we have perfect income equality, which means everybody has the same income. Very straightforward. At Gini coefficient of 1, perfect income inequality. One person has all the income, everybody else has nothing. I would argue to you that those are both bad, that it's obvious to see why one person having all the income is bad because, you know, what do the rest of us do? You can see bribery and cronyism and exploitation very easily in that. But I'm not sure that a Gini income of 0 or Gini coefficient of 0 is what we should be advocating for either. But that's kind of where the debate leans. I mean, you don't see people, policymakers particularly, saying we need to get to 0 where everybody has equality. I don't hear that in the United States very much, but you hear people saying we need to get more towards equality. And the question is why? And I think you can't answer that question without knowing how do people get their income? That's why this is tied to the capitalism argument. If Bill Gates is getting his income because he's getting political bribes and he has a monopoly privilege that's guaranteed to him by the state and he doesn't have to work hard, there's nothing biblical in any of that. There's no industriousness, there's no stewardship, there's no human creativity. And so we would say that's bad and it actually protects him from competition and that hurts the rest of us. The flip side is equally disturbing, which is how do we get income equality? And should we? Well, I don't think that we necessarily should. And I in my own chapter, and Vernon Smith and Joy Buchanan in their chapter, lean on the parable of the talents when trying to answer this. And we say, you know, if you read that parable, what you see is that the master leaves 3 servants in charge of his resources, his talents. Talents is literally translated bag of gold. So we're talking cash. And he gives 1 5, 1 2, and 1 1 talent. And if you read the text, it says, each given according to his ability. Now, it's a parable. It's a story. What does a story tell us? Well, we each have different abilities. And they're worth different things. And God only promises us that if we use our talents and our abilities to the best of our abilities, that he will bless us. It doesn't say you're guaranteed to be Bill Gates. But what we know about human flourishing from Pennington's chapter is he doesn't want us to live in destitute poverty either. So this is a very complicated topic because, number one, I think there's confusion even over how we measure it. I won't even get into all the problems with measuring it. It's hard to know how this changes over time unless you're following individual tax returns, which is a very hard thing to do. And so I don't think we have a real clear picture of how unequal we actually are. That's one thing I'll say. And the other thing I know for sure is that the Gini coefficient doesn't tell us how people earn their wealth. Did they earn it because they're cronyists and they're rent seekers, to use an economics term, or did they earn it because they worked really hard and they created something amazing for the rest of us, like laptop computers and cell phones and pacemakers? I want the people that invent those things to be rich because I benefit from it, right? And I can't do those things on my own. So it's a very nuanced topic. And I think we need some clarity on it. And, you know, my chapter is just a stab at that. But I think a lot more work can and needs to be done on the topic.
If you could use 2 terms there, cronyism or crony capitalism and rent seeking, if you could just give our audience, who not all of them are economists, a brief definition of what rent seeking is, because they're thinking, am I looking for an apartment? Right. You know, that's the same thing with my students. So what are those 2 things? They tend to be interrelated.
Sure. So this idea of rent seeking is kind of, you break down the term, seeking a rent, seeking a benefit, seeking a gain. Now, we're all seeking a gain, right? We talk about this in the book a lot. We're all profit maximizers. We all want to get what we want at the least amount of cost to us. That's just kind of being self-interested, I think. But rent-seeking, in the way economists use it, particularly applies to the role of that rent-seeker and the state. So in other words, if I am a, you know, electric car company, to use a modern example, and I want subsidies for pursuing technology around creating electric cars under the rubric of, you know, environmental prudence, then I might try to get perks, benefits, subsidies. I might try to close out my competition, and I use political bargaining to do that. So, you know, we used to say in the economics profession, we used to say rent-seeking, and I think it's kind of now we use the word cronyism. So cronyism, you know, is this idea that these large, typically large corporations, because they have the capital to do it, spend a lot of money seeking favors and benefits and protections from the state. And this is something that I am very worried about as someone who thinks about income inequality, because I actually think it gets you the worst kind of income inequality. I try to make the claim in the book, or I do make the claim in the book, that, you know, if Bill Gates gets his riches by helping me out and giving me these computer systems that make my life better, I'm all for it, because I'm better too. And I voluntarily go to the store and buy all the things he gives me. But if Bill Gates gets his money because he's gotten, you know, favors and he's locking out his competition, then he's able to stay rich, and we lose innovation and we lose competition. And so there's other small companies that never get to compete. So markets become rigged. And I think this leads to the worst type of income inequality, true exploitation via the political process versus just someone having a great idea and being able to become very wealthy from that. That's a good thing because we all benefit from that creativity.
One of the other things that I like that you do in this chapter is, and you mentioned a little bit before we talk about that, we each have different gifts. And one of the things I think Christianity does is it tells us that we're all very different. Some people are going to be really good at doing some things that provide lots of benefits for lots of people, like a Bill Gates, and that brings them lots of income in return. Other people might not be as good at that kind of thing. They might not get as much returns, but those things are just as important. I always, you know, reference my bartender. I think my bartender is incredibly important. I have a couple bartenders at my favorite tavern that just serve me very well, and they're great friends and everything, and those are beautiful talents to have. And I think Christianity says, you know, all these talents are beautiful, even though they don't result in the same type of observable wealth or income at the end of the day.
Such an important point, because we tend to, and I've said it 1,000 times already in this interview, we tend to talk about Bill Gates's, you know, of the world. And yes, they're important, but you're right. Christianity means, I mean, part of the beauty, I think, of Christianity is first God's grace, and his creation of us. I mean, he didn't need us. He wanted us. And he knew kind of all the ways we're going to screw it up. But each of us has something to offer the universe. And capitalism is the way that enables the bartender to have a beautiful relationship with you, as well as other people that have different relationships with you in your life. And if you'll permit me, if we have time, there's a story that I like to share with my students that I think detail or, you know, exemplifies your point that you just made very well about the different, you know, the bartender and how important they are. And in the market economy, you know, we elevate everyone. And it's the story of my daughter. So she's 4. I have a 7-year-old son and a 4-year-old daughter. And my daughter was born, well, my water broke at 26 weeks, which is extremely premature. I was rushed into the hospital in the middle of the night and confirmed that my water had broken. And once that happens, you're not leaving the hospital. And so, you know, at the hospital, they said, we can't even have you here because we don't accept micro preemies. And if your daughter's born tomorrow, that's what you'll have. So I was transferred by ambulance to a teaching hospital down the road. And I was on 5 weeks of hospital bed rest. And every 4 hours they would come and do all these tests. They would take my blood pressure and my temperature and monitor the baby. And every 4 hours that nothing bad happened, we were just a little victory. And there were, you know, med students and nurses and doctors, and they're, you know, all in there all the time. And every day was a victory that I didn't have her. And she was finally born at 31 weeks. And at 31 weeks, And I usually, in my classroom, I'll put a picture up of her and what she, how she lived for the first 5 weeks of her life. She lived basically in an incubator. She had monitors tracking her heart rate. She was kind of wrapped in this kind of inner tube thing that kept her body warm because preemies can't regulate their heart rate or their temperature, and they can't feed themselves. And so on that last point, they can't feed themselves. There's a little tiny tube taped to her mouth that went into her nose and down to her stomach. And it basically fed her. And I had, you know, you can imagine during this time, I had a lot of time to think. And we thought a lot about the neurosurgeons and the pediatric specialists and all these brilliant people that were helping us. But, you know, I thought and thought and thought about this way that she was getting food and this little tiny tube that was taped to her face. And I did a little research on it, and there's a guy that you've never heard of named Henry Turkel, and he filed the patent for that feeding tube in 1951. He was working with Down babies who can't suck, and so they needed a way to get the food into their belly. And he applied for this patent in 1951, and he helped save my daughter's life. And he came up with an idea 70 years before she was even born. And at that time, it wasn't even used for preemies because they died. So it's an amazing story. And then I thought about it more, and I thought, well, gosh, there's a FedEx driver who every month or week or whenever it happens delivers those feeding tubes in boxes to the hospital. This seems very mundane. But this person plays a critical role in saving lives. And there's a janitor at the hospital. And the janitor takes the, you know, cleans up the boxes after all the tubes are put away on the shelf. And the janitor plays a critical role in saving lives. So the market economy is the only way that we've seen where all sorts of ordinary people with all sorts of different talents are brought together through their own self-interest to care about my daughter, who they don't know. And, you know, I can never even say thank you to half these people because I don't know who they are. That's an amazing thing. And I think gets nicely to your point about we all have different talents and they're all valuable.
Oh, that's an amazing story, very touching story that illustrates these points. And it also had me thinking, too, it's we oftentimes tend to conflate status, human dignity, and wealth by lumping those all together, that if you, you know, have billions of dollars, then you've made it in the human dignity and status game. But, you know, in reality, you know, status of people like the FedEx driver or this guy who invented the tube, he probably did well for himself. But, you know, again, in the broad sweep of history, he's lost in the memories of all of us. So, but very cool story.
Yeah.
So one of the things that you attempt to do both at your institute and in this book a little bit is to talk about what can Christians do about this thing, specifically in terms of their vocations. And what do you mean by in terms of their vocations? Because I'm not a priest or a pastor, so I guess I'm off the hook there. I don't have to do anything, or maybe not. And what can Christians do about inequality if they're concerned about it? What prescriptions do you have?
Yeah, so, and again, I think this is a tough one. I first think we need to understand it better. And so that comes for Christians first. How do we think about inequality? Now, we have a little bit of a narrative to think about that. It's not all bad. It doesn't all need fixing, but some of it might. And so understanding that that piece that the market is going to I love the point you just made, by the way, this point that we lump in kind of fame and money and wealth with dignity. No, that's not the Christian way to understand humans and why we're here. You know, dignity comes outside of wealth entirely. And so, you know, we want a system that elevates the human dignity of everybody, not just the rich and famous. And so I think what I'm worried about is when we ask the question, what do we do to fix it? There are no simple solutions. There's not going to be just a quick policy fix. Piketty and others are advocating a very large kind of global wealth tax, in some cases up to 80%. And so this is kind of another call for redistribution of resources, but that doesn't solve the fundamental problem. Sure, if we redistribute to the very poorest, we might be able to help them temporarily. I mean, but the real quest of a Christian is how do we permanently help people out of poverty? How do we do that? And I don't think claims for redistribution empirically do that. I think, again, they might be needed in some cases. But again, we can have another debate about how you do that. I think privately it's done much more effectively because it's voluntary and, you know, we're close to the people we want to help. So I think we need to understand good versus bad inequality. Now, the bad inequality, cronyism, corporatism, this is something that I believe that Christians can have a voice on this issue and should. And so part of it is just looking for it and calling it out and not tolerating it. I mean, in the age of social media, we can do a lot with our little voices. And so I think, you know, calling cronyism when we see it is the first step in just having other people recognize it's a problem. Because I think most people go to bed at night, and cronyism isn't something they're worried about. I realize I'm a weird economist. I do worry about it. But I think it's pervasive. There's a culture of cronyism. And it's just expected that as you get richer as a corporation, you're going to kind of seek political favors. And I think this is very damaging to an economy. So I think we have to be very thoughtful and careful about how we approach it. But I wouldn't just rush to redistribution as the solution, because again, you know, if we could, this is a thought experiment I like to do in my classroom as well. Let's just say that we could collect everybody's income, everybody's, you know, assets, put them in a big pot and divide them out equally amongst every person. Let's say we could do that. We probably could do that. I mean, technically it's not that hard, right? And we do that on day one. Everybody's equal. Everybody has the same amount of money. Well, what happens on day two? Or day five, or month three, or year two. I mean, there's no way to sustain that equality. Why? Because of the fact that we're different. I mean, some people are going to go and put it all on the craps table and lose it. And some are going to put it on the craps table and double down. And some are never going to go to the craps table. They're going to invest in different businesses. So it's because of the nature of our diversity that income equality, true perfect income inequality, is not a sustainable objective. So I think, you know, a kind of a nuanced conversation around how do you elevate the good inequality and put the brakes on the bad in its income equality, and really how do we focus on income mobility? Those are kind of the ways I would like to see the conversation progress.
Yeah, a very interesting thought experiment. I do something similar in my classes, and I find out that students don't like it too much. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
They love it in the abstract. But then when you say, okay, we're going to do everybody, here's a big box, everybody toss in all your stuff, your books and computers and laptops, phones, all that kind of stuff. And they're like, so very interesting. So a lot of good stuff in this book. We haven't touched upon all the things. There's issues about environmentalism, which is a hot topic nowadays. So folks can go ahead and purchase this book. We'll link to it on our website. It's called Counting the Cost, Christian Perspectives on Capitalism. I want to finish off, though, with some reflections that you have. You've been thinking about this for some time now, both in your work with IFWE and your graduate school time. You've been a Christian for a long time. You're a trained economist. In the course of your studies, has there been anything within economic analysis that's really challenged your Christian beliefs, or your Christian beliefs challenging the way economists do things?
These are great questions, and you know, as I reflect on my time as an economist and how I think about the world and what's changed, I really think that my time at IFWE, which has really helped me become much more theologically informed and educated, working alongside theologians has been incredibly helpful. And I think that if I had to be really honest, they were a little wary of me, and I was a little wary of them. I thought, you know, and talk about everything in terms of cost-benefit analysis and money and things like that. And I'm not sure exactly what I was worried about, but maybe they would be dismissive of the economic way of thinking. And I have to say, I think what's been most important in my journey is that I've had to explicitly put my economic way of thinking to the test and been willing to say, what if I really learn from theologians and I find out that all the stuff I learned about economics is wrong. Would I be willing to change my mind about capitalism, about economics as a discipline? Those are kind of scary things to think about. But I think going in with your eyes wide open, and especially in an interdisciplinary way, you always have something to learn, so I very much appreciate that. I think it's made me a better thinker. I don't think that there's one thing in particular, but I guess where maybe I disagree with my colleagues is what, you know, what does the Bible have to say about the proper role of government, and what does that mean in 2017? And I think there's more thinking I need to do on that, but I kind of take a much more libertarian position on some of those ideas, which is that maybe there is a positive role for government, but does that mean that it's the federal government in the way that we understand it in the United States in 2017? I'm not so convinced that that's true. So those are kind of some of the debates that we have, and I really enjoy having them. And so that's just one example, but I'm sure there's more. But yeah, I mean, I think it's really a hard thing to put everything you know to the test and say, how am I going to come out on the other side? And to be thoughtful and honest about it, it's a hard thing, but it's a good thing.
It definitely is a good thing. The thinking process never does stop, because if it did stop, we would be out of a job.
That's right.
And I wouldn't know what to do then.
Not very interesting, right?
Yeah, yeah, because I don't have any other talents beyond this. So, Yeah. So, but it is a great book. It was great talking to you. My guest today has been Dr. Anne Rathbone Bradley. Anne, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony, for having me. It was fun.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.